My name is Jerry McLean. I'm the executive director of VPTC. It's a wonderful pleasure to have you here this afternoon. For those of you who were here for our first technology town hall, choosing our future Austin or Aspen last January, welcome back. To those of you who are just joining us for this conversation, we appreciate you being here. We're actually going to catch you up on the conversation so you won't have missed anything. And then we really want to have you join us as the conversation continues. We've got a lot of exciting folks in the room. There's very important people here. This is really kind of a who's who of the business, technology, and entrepreneurial community here in our area. So we are delighted to have this type of group here. The conversation that we started last month has really spread and taken some root and some momentum, and we're excited to hear that. It made its way into the Daily Progress. It's made its way onto the local airwaves, on the television, in the blog sphere, on the listservs, and even at birthday parties. My wife took our 7-year-old son to a birthday party last week, and some of the guest parents were commiserating about some of the challenges that we have and looking to the conversation that we've been having here as part of what needs to be addressed. So the conversation is spreading everywhere, and that's great. What we're going to do is have Mike Drawl give the introductions to both Harvey Ring and to Gary Henry, and then Gary will kind of catch you up to speed on some of the highlights from the Technology Town Hall 1, as well as talk about some of the things that we're doing that's new and different. And then Harvey Ring will take you through a great conversation on building the technology base. And with that, let me turn it over to Mike Drawl, LeClaire Ryan. Mike?
Well, good afternoon. On behalf of LeClaire Ryan, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the second Technology Town Hall meeting. Things are moving, and as a result of the recently announced combination of the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council and the Charlottesville Venture Group, I'm especially pleased to have the privilege of announcing or introducing the first event presented under the banner of the combined organization VPTC-CVG. Got to work on the name, but that'll come too. Before I continue any further, I'd really like you to join me in congratulating the leadership of both organizations. I was tangentially involved in some of the work behind the scenes to engineer the combination of the organizations, but there are some people who really spent a tremendous amount of time and dedicated a lot of vision, tenacity, and leadership to bring this together. And I really do believe that the combined organization is going to forever change the dialogue regarding economic growth in the region and the direction it takes. So please join me in just congratulating the leadership, Gary, and I saw Elizabeth Pyle. Okay, thank you. I've got a vision for this region, and hopefully some people in the room will share it or it'll resonate with a few people. Earlier in my career, I lived in Northern Virginia and worked in D.C. Part of that time, I was a Coast Guard JAG officer, and part of it, I was a corporate attorney. But no matter what the circumstances, every time I crossed the 14th Street Bridge, I kind of got this rush, a real visceral surge of energy that told me that something exciting and important was going on. And now, a whole lot of years later, I occasionally get back to the D.C. metro area, and I get that same feeling when I cross the 14th Street Bridge. Now, Charlottesville is never going to be D.C. I don't think anybody here in this room would embrace a vision like that. And I'm not advocating it, that's for sure. But wouldn't it be great, as you exited off 64 and headed towards Charlottesville, to get some of that energy rush and surge? Think about that for a minute. Hold that thought while we turn to the business at hand. Make no mistake about it, choosing a future is serious business, and what we're talking about here are alternative futures for the region. One future is a sleepy college town that has turned into a nice retirement community with housing prices in the stratosphere and few opportunities to hold young people here. Aspen. Yes, people are really comfortable in that future, at least the ones who can afford it. Lots of entertainment venues, nice restaurants, living in a region lacking in vitality and unable to hold on to its talented young people. No critical mass to keep them here. That's one future. Our first speaker, Katie Bullard, from Technology Town Hall Number 1 of Angelou Economics, pointed out a statistic that really caught my attention, and I think it's worth bringing it to your attention again, and that was that the fastest growing segment of the population in the Charlottesville MSA is 64 and older. I submit to you that on our present course and speed, that the future that we're heading for is the one that I just described. Nice, but probably pretty uninspiring, pretty unexciting. The other future is considerably brighter, but it would really require, I think, a course correction and a commitment. A vibrant community with a technology-based economy that attracts and keeps the best and brightest. A community that still has the entertainment venues, the nice restaurants, but keeps and attracts bright, motivated, well-educated, entrepreneurial young people in addition to the retirees attracted here by the quality of life, Austin. So as I remarked the last time we were together, will Charlottesville really settle for being part of what it can be, or will it really pursue a broader, brighter vision to become all it's capable of? And believe me, there's a lot of parts and pieces already here. I submit to you that the choice is really ours. A lot of leaders in the room today. But if the brighter, fuller future is really to become a reality, the time for action is really now, beginning today. So having framed that debate or choice for you in some pretty stark terms, let me introduce our guides for the choices that have to be made, Gary Henry and Harvey Ring. With the vital Austin-Aspen debate for our region having begun in the last section, their job will really be to bring forth some suggestions as to what it would take to reach out for that brighter future that I just described for you. Now I'm going to introduce both speakers so as not to break the flow of the conversation, so bear with me. Two very accomplished people here. Gary Henry is the principal consultant of G.F. Henry & Associates, which is a management consulting firm located here in Charlottesville. He's got more than 30 years of distinguished experience spanning leadership, strategy, business process, change management, finance, IT, and marketing. Before founding G.F. Henry & Associates, he was the chairman and chief operating officer of Dominion Digital. And that during his tenure, Dominion Digital was named one of the 50 fastest growing companies in Virginia. Prior to that, he was with General Electric and spent a lot of time in Europe opening offices across the continent. Since leaving GE, Gary's been the founder or startup principal six times. He's been a CEO, a CFO, and a COO. He was named an Ernst & Young Virginia Entrepreneur of the Year in 2001. He's a member of the boards of the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council, which is no longer that, it's VPTC CVG, where he, and also he's on the Charlottesville Regional Chamber of Commerce, where he chairs the Technology Roundtable. He's a graduate of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Electrical Engineering. Our guest lecturer and keynote speaker today is Harvey Ring. He's the president of Ring Investments LP, an investment and consulting company that specializes in the technology industry. He's contributed to the growth of early stage companies in Austin, including, and I have to read these are interesting names, Factory Logic Software, Inside Out Networks, Eureka Environmental, Precision Traffic Systems, and others. He's currently working, and these are another set of interesting names, Anexity, Facilities Technology Group, Advantage Mortgage Network, and VoxPath Networks in Austin. He serves on a number of boards in Austin on various companies. He's a partner in the National Investment Market, a company created to help early stage companies become profitable. Prior to building his own businesses, Mr. Ring served as the vice president of Dellware for the Dell Computer Corporation. He's managed two VC-backed startups as CEO, and he's the vice chair on the board of the Austin Technology Council. He holds an MBA in marketing and finance from the University of Michigan, earned a PhD in, this is really something, high energy physics, an MS in physics, and a BSE in physics from the University of Michigan. So please join me now in welcoming our first speaker, Gary Henry, who will tee things up by recapping some of the remarks from our previous section and set the stage for Harvey Ring.
Well, it's really great to see so many people here. It's definitely encouraging that the conversation is of interest to a broader part of the community, because it is obviously very important to all of us. Let me take you briefly through what happened at the Town Hall 1, but I also have a few things that have actually happened since the first Town Hall to report on as well. I started before, and I want to use the same quote again because I think it's so important, and that is that the future can arrive unannounced. And I think we're in an environment in Charlottesville where the outcome of our efforts now won't really be recognized for quite some time. If you were to go back 20 years and imagine what you thought Charlottesville would be like from that point in time, you would never imagine what we have now. You would not imagine the price of the houses. You would not imagine the number of people or the traffic or any of those things. Equally true is that I don't think you can imagine what the future is like unless you really give some careful thought to it. And I think let us propose what some of those are like. One of the reasons for the phenomenon we're experiencing is the rest of the world has defined us many times in many headlines. And as a result of that notoriety, a lot of people have been attracted to our area. And I would say that it's nice to have those sort of accolades. However, this is a lot of other people defining who we are and what we are. And it's about time we started doing something to define for ourselves who we are and what we want to be. Outside of those headlines written elsewhere, if we look at the headlines that are written here locally, we see a fairly different story, talking about the underemployment that occurs, about the loss of jobs, about the shrinking of our middle class, about the danger of having affordable housing any longer. These are definitely things that we all need to take action on, and there's already been lots of dialogue. This is a well-known conversation in the community. So let's look at some of the characteristics that would describe our area. And here's a list of them. And they're fairly good things. A good place to retire. A place that attracts the wealthy. Economic diversity, however, is weakening somewhat. Tourism is strong, as is the environment is very beautiful here. We have a great university. We're fairly culturally diverse, could be more so, but we're fairly good. We have a small but growing tech community, and we have a fairly strong arts community, and that's getting a little bit better. But if we can take these same characteristics that are listed here, we can also see how those characteristics can lead to a very different future down the road. Two different destinations. If we separate those characteristics into two groups, one of the milestones that would be at the end of those characteristics would be Aspen, Colorado, and the other would be Austin, Texas. Now, I want to be clear, because I've gotten so many emails about this before, I'm not saying that we'll ever be exactly like Aspen, Colorado, nor am I saying we'll ever be exactly like Austin, Texas. We'll never probably be as expensive as Aspen, nor as large as Austin. However, there is a lot to learn from the characteristics of how Aspen has gone from something not too different than we are right now to what they are today, and equally by how Austin has gone from something that's very much like what we are today to what it is. So I think that really says that we have a choice to make. We are at a crossroads where we can have influence of whether we go down a path that's much more like Aspen, Colorado, or much more like Austin, Texas. And let's look at just some of what those differences are. If you look at just the cost of living on a national basis, well, Austin is about 5% less expensive than the national average. Charlottesville is about 10% more expensive. And Aspen is about 4 times as expensive. A pretty remarkable number. And then also, if you look at these are 2005 numbers. If you look at the median house price, Austin, Texas at $164,000, Charlottesville at $255,000, and Aspen at $3,100,000. So I want to give you an update, too. Those numbers have changed. I now have, at least for Charlottesville and Aspen, what the 2006 numbers are. And listed here, the 255,000 for Charlottesville has gone up to just slightly below 275,000, an increase of $25,000. On the other hand, in Aspen, Colorado, it has now gone up to $4,150,000, an increase of over $1 million in the median house price in 1 year. By the way, that's about a 30% increase. Not too much different to the increase we've experienced right here, just already further up the scale. Something we should be keeping an eye on. Also, look at the state of the middle class. Aspen, by its own admission, has practically no middle class. They have to import their workers from outside the area. The people who work in city government have to live in subsidized housing. It's a fairly stark situation. Whereas Austin has a fairly strong middle class. And I think we can all say that we're at least a little bit at risk here. So we have a very vibrant and strong retirement and tourism community, 64 and older being the largest growing age segment in our metropolitan statistical area. So we are rapidly becoming more and more a retirement community. Tourism in 2005 grew 6.3%, much faster than a lot of other things. Those are okay, but by themselves, that's not very good because it's going to lead to something that's much more like Aspen, Colorado. We need something to balance it off, and we have already here, small, but needing to be stronger, a technology and innovation community, which is a component that's a little bit like Austin, Texas. And we need to do more in order to strengthen that, not to replace the other, but to provide balance for it so that we have an opportunity to maintain some diversity in our economy. So why would we choose, of all the things we could pick to put on the other side of the fulcrum there to balance things out, why would we choose technology? Well, because technology is the best wealth generator, it's the best job generator. It outperforms any other sector. And this is not new news. This is a global phenomenon, much less a national one, that technology is the key to an economy. And inside the United States, you can see how efficient it is in that only 4% of the U.S. workforce can generate 35% of the GDP. That's a lot of bang for a pretty small buck. A very important characteristic if we want to have a pretty big bang here for a very small impact on our local infrastructure, on our quality of life. Probably, if you don't remember any other statistic, any other piece of data from this discussion, remember this one. If they're at all right about that, this is extremely important. 65% of the difference in economic success in any region can be attributed to the presence of the technology sector. If that's true, then shouldn't we strengthen ours in order to help use this to leverage success for our area? If you look at the wages and how they've changed from 1995 to 2005, over that span of time, it's a little hard to see. You don't hardly see the top line the way it turned out. But there's been a steady premium on the wages for technology jobs. If you just look at the broad statistics over that same period of time, the number of technology firms has grown at 6.5 times the national average, the employment in them 3 times, the payroll 2.5 times, and the average wages 1.6 times over that span of time. Nothing outperforms technology for being able to deliver to your local economy. And obviously, you know, the local government would benefit by having some success in that area. And also, very important, keeping in mind where our growth is in terms of age demographics, it helps attract and retain 25 to 44-year-olds because they are the ones who are predominantly working in that particular industry. So, you know, what would this really look like here? Does this mean adding technology to our region means that we have some big plant come in and somewhere off of 64 or 29 there's a huge piece of land with a huge building going in? No, it does not. That is not what would be appropriate for our area. That's not what we're advocating. We would like to have much of the same that we have already. 80% of the members of the Technology Council, of just the technology ones, are all 25 people or smaller. That's the kind of companies we already have here, and that's what we would have. We believe that the R&D that already occurs in the companies that are here are the kind that we would have. It's not companies that are manufacturing, it's not companies that are producing, it are companies that are researching, designing, innovating, creating intellectual property here. And as a result, they can be quite small, and they can fit into almost any office space we have here. You would hardly know that they're there. Matter of fact, you probably don't even recognize the 300 or so technology companies that we already have here for that very reason. They blend into the woodwork pretty well, the vast majority of them. We also believe that this is going to be a balance between not only attracting some of those small companies here, but also growing those companies here, something both of which are already happening in this area. So the entrepreneurship is a key component to making this work. Infrastructure should have very little impact from this type of growth. Now, let's look at some of the technologies. These are some that are already occurring in our area that have some promise. Bioconvergence is sort of a term where there are many kinds of technologies that all have some impact on life sciences. Everything from software to hardware to mechanical design for medical devices, information and data types of technologies, the spectrum all apply to this. And we already have a fair start of that here. Nanotechnology could equally be a part of the bioconvergence as well, but it has multiple other applications. And we have some software and IT here, not quite as strong as it once was before the bubble, but still here. And we've had some gaming company success and also some energy success. Here are some of the recent announcements of successes in technology in the area. And again, I would submit, I don't think people have seen any huge infrastructure impact by the result of these successes occurring. I would like to see more of these. And now, this is a chart that Katie provided to us at the last one, which is a fairly complicated but interesting chart in that it shows those things on the left are growing, or shrinking actually, on a national scale, and those things that are far on the right are growing on a national scale. And on the vertical scale are those things that have a small concentration in our area to a larger one. So literally speaking, I guess those things like biotechnology right here in the center, that's something we have in our area. It's growing at about the same rate as the national sector in biotechnology is growing. And it's a little bit bigger than other things in the area. If we looked at things that would have the opportunity to grow, we could see that these things are weak locally and growing nationally. They would have an opportunity to be a little bit bigger. We can see software and IT would be something that could be a little bit bigger. So here's two technology companies. Almost off the scale is that higher education has grown pretty good nationally and is also very strong locally, obviously because of the university, as are the hospitals in the big red ball right there. So we have already quite a spectrum of things, some of which are going away. That bottom left-hand corner, you can pretty much say those sectors are fighting, you know, the national trend and are already declining here. They're going away. So those things in the right half of the chart are things we should pay attention to, selecting which ones we'd like to support to grow. So what are some common traits among areas that have succeeded? And Harvey is going to talk to us about some of the things that have worked and not worked in Austin already. But here's just sort of a spectrum of areas, and we have a few pieces of data on that. But here are the things that help a high-tech area succeed. A prominent university, well-educated young population, a creative entrepreneurial environment, excellent quality of life, robust R&D, and a strong venture capital source. Now, I think we have some of these. I think we have some of all of these. Let's see how some of these things compare to those other areas.
Here are a number of statistics. I'll let you read some of those, but two that I'd like to point out are that really illustrate part of the problem and the challenge of our area. The median home price, and this is a 2006 number, compared to Austin, you can see that we're considerably more expensive, almost by $100,000. At the same time, our average tech wages, not average wages, average tech wages are actually lower than Austin's. That's a bit of a challenge.
If we look at some of the specifics in the wages, we have a few that are below and a few that are above.
I think most notable there is maybe the difference in the software publishers, but on average, our wages are a little bit lower.
And if we look at our sources of VC funding,
Charlottesville is that second small sliver out of the, what looks like Pac-Man that's Northern Virginia's VC funding. So we have a fairly small piece of the pie. It would be nice for it to be larger, but it's also not that far away. So there are some opportunities there too. So how do we roughly compare? And this was Katie Bullard's sort of just taking a stab at it, not a definitive analysis. Yes, we have a prominent university. We can get an A for that. Well-educated young population. Well, there are some few here, so we don't do too well there. The ones that the university produces, the vast majority of them depart the area. Creative entrepreneurial component, a B. Quality of life, A, absolutely. Something we all want to preserve as an A also. Robust R&D, about a B, and the venture capital, because it's not as local as we'd like it to be, a C. So, you know, with what we have, what else does it take in order to start taking some steps along this path? Well, it takes the vision leadership, and especially it takes regional cooperation. It takes us agreeing to adopt a strategy, where before, you know, I don't think there has been a strategy that involves technology or a strategy that says let's balance our economy with some other choice. And obviously we need to put the resources and everything together to make that happen. In terms of that cooperation, we have already reached out to the private sector, to all of these, and have had discussions with most of these already. And we would like to broaden even that group. So if any of you are a member of or have a connection to any other private sector group that should be involved in the conversation, we would like to talk with you. We would like to meet. We would like to see where we can cooperate together, because the cooperation is key to making this happen. So to build a technology-based economy, we need help. This is not something that any one organization here can do. It's going to take several in order to make that happen. And it's going to take a public-private partnership to also make that happen. So some of the things that we have as initiatives, and we described these before, was to bring this conversation to the community in the first place, engage everybody in this dialogue. We're also developing a technology incubator, which will be online this year, to help nurture those tech-based businesses that will be growing right here in our area. And also we want to continue our longstanding efforts in workforce development. We've had some great cooperation from PVCC on that. And we have a number of initiatives which are involved with young people, because we take a very long-term view of making this happen. Matter of fact, one of those, the Virginia Piedmont Regional Science Fair, which attracts 300 students from all over our region, all the way up near Dahlgren to down below Charlottesville, takes place in only a couple of weeks on March 8th at the University of Virginia. Your support of things like that would also help, and there are still opportunities to provide support to it. So what are we doing that's new? Well, I can tell you a few things that have happened since we met the last time, those of you who were here before. And the first of those is developing a Piedmont Technology Index. If we're going to do this, we need to know what kind of progress we're making. Are we making a difference? And is it happening at the rate at which we'd like to have it happen? and we need to report on that on a regular basis. So we're already in talks with a number of people about making that happen, and we're also looking for funding and underwriting to help make that index happen. So if any of you have interest in that, please see me or anybody with the VPTC CVG. Also, announced, I think, for the first time here in public, we do have our first public partnership with the City of Charlottesville to promote the city as a home for technology businesses. We will be working with the city in order to determine what segments we would like to attract here and what would be the best way in order to reach them with a message that makes the city seem like an attractive place for them to either start or move an R&D division or even a small technology company coming to Charlottesville. For our positive attributes. Also, as has already been announced by on Tuesday of this week, and we also had Mike mention that too, the VPTC and the CBG have joined forces together, and I think this is a huge step on our part toward this goal. We're telling you the cooperation is important. Well, two of the key constituents have decided it's so important that they've gotten together in order to help make this happen. So we now have the entrepreneurship component that we believe is an important piece of this strategy going forward. So in our portfolio of events that we had from before, adding these two of the incubator and the index, we're now going to be adding those that came from the CVG as well, which will include the annual business forum and the live fire and the morning education events, among others. So that our support of entrepreneurism will also be added to the overall portfolio of what we now should be called, until we rename it to a better name, VPTC CVG. And for us to succeed, what should the very next steps be? Well, we want to continue to work toward adopting technology-based economic development as a strategy to balance our economy. We want to have that happen. We have to have the will and the resources to make that happen. We're taking some steps. We'd like to have more partners to join in that, and I hope some of you have interest in being a partner in it. Some actions have already begun by learning what has worked and not worked in other areas, and Harvey will be the first of that. If there's enough interest, we may have some other areas come and speak to us about what has worked and what has not, what are the lessons learned from other areas, potentially even including those from Virginia. We're also going to be working on the incubator, as I mentioned before, and some further steps are to strengthen the cooperation among both the private and the public sector groups in order to help make this happen. I can't emphasize that enough, and I am putting out a plea for those who have interest and belief in this to join in the cause. And obviously we need to work on implementing a roadmap. And for this roadmap, we don't have to create anything new. This is something that has been done in many, many other places, and we can adopt what works best for us, for our unique situation, to get a good solution for Charlottesville and the greater area. So, what we really need is your help. And I hope you're interested enough in this outcome and in your area to invest in making that happen. And if you're inclined enough, please feel also, we would love to have you join the VPTC and the VPTC CVG now as a friend, as an underwriter, as a partner to help make this happen. If there is no other outlet for you to provide some cooperation for this, this is one opportunity. I would ask you to consider that too. So with that, I'd like to turn the floor over to Harvey to tell us about what we can learn from the experience in Austin, Texas.
Well, I don't usually do these sorts of things. I'm retired. I usually have small meetings of entrepreneurs trying to help them grow their businesses. And so this is kind of a special event for me. And I hope I can provide some insights as to what we've done in Austin that's worked and how you might apply those strategies here in Charlottesville. I think the the way we need to go about that is kind of an orderly process way, and that's kind of how I built my little pitch here about what you can do. But let me just go back a little bit and give you a little bit of my background. You got introduced to a lot of companies, but realistically, it all started when I went to college. I'm a University of Michigan Big Ten guy, so Southeast Conference? Is that Virginia? What? Atlantic Coast Conference. Yeah, so we'll not make any jokes. Michigan doesn't have a very good basketball team, but they have a fairly decent football team these days. But after I got my PhD in physics and was a postdoc for a couple of years at Michigan, I had to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And it didn't look like working for the university was the right thing to do. So I looked around. I got some help from the professors at the university, and I found a couple of startup tech companies actually in the Ann Arbor area. And I joined one, and that kind of got my interest into early stage companies and starting them up. And I also worked for a number of very large companies. The startup happened to be acquired by Automatic Data Processing, ADP. I suspect ADP has an office here in town. They have it almost all over the country. And I worked for ITT and some other large companies, British Telecom, for example. After I, over a long period of time, after experiencing both big and small companies, what I've done is I've come back to the small companies because you can really make a difference, and it's really a lot of fun. And so since I retired my last real job, I've been working with early stage companies and actually having a lot of fun, and that's part of it. But I've learned a lot of things. Let me ask you, I don't know anything about the audience, and so I'm going to see if I can get a little audience participation. Trying to understand, how many of you really work for the public sector? Okay, that's government and university, okay. And the rest, I presume, is private, right? And then just a show of hands, how many work for bigger companies, bigger organizations, have experience with big companies and small organizations? Okay, most of it's small. Well, that's good. I think a lot of what I say will be addressed to the both public as well as the small companies, because that's really what we're talking about here. Let's see, now I've, there we go. We really have two choices. It's not a choice of whether I'll build or recruit. It's really important to do both. Because if you don't do one of them, then you won't really generate any activity in that area, and that's kind of a shame. Now, I can't tell you whether half the activity will be in a recruit and half the activity that will result is in build. But I can tell you that they're synergistic together. But there are also areas where particular segments of this area can focus on. For example, public-private partnerships are very good in the recruiting area, putting together brochures and marketing the area to attract a research arm of a company out of the D.C. area or New York or New Jersey would be a very positive thing, and that really needs to market the area. There's lots of companies looking to create another site for lots of reasons that people would like to move to or grow in, and that's an opportunity. These are, maybe it's not the first site, maybe it's the second site. Or maybe it's a foreign company coming in, and instead of paying the high prices in Washington, D.C., it would be nice to open up their office here in Charlottesville. I don't know where they're going to come from. But it's important to have that strategy and to have a group of organizations, which are typically public-private. You know, you think of the chamber and the city or the county or even the state, because in Texas, the state gets involved in this stuff also because of the way we do our things, our tax incentives and what have you. But in small deals, there's really no tax incentive. I mean, it's only the big deals where the government gets involved in. But the willingness to have the political leaders say, you know, this is a good place to be, it's a friendly government, da-da-da, whatever it is, pitching it so that you've got that public-private partnership is an important component of it. I'm going to use the chip business, which doesn't apply here, but I think it's a good example of what has happened in Austin and where it came from, and then what the city and companies did to leverage it. And I think there's some lessons learned here. So this is a little bit of history of the Austin chip world. Way back in the early 70s, AMD was searching for a place to put a fab, and they were in California, if I'm not mistaken, Sunnyvale or something like that. Anyway, California was not the place to put a fab. And Austin had a lot of the resources, and it was an attractive place. I don't think the city or the state gave them any benefits other than there's some electricity here, there's plenty of water and lots of people, and maybe there's a little bit of economic development, meaning I don't know. But but that was 30 years ago. And that was, you know, depending upon how you look at it, just luck. Then Motorola moved a fab from Phoenix to Austin, and so we had a couple of fabs, and then from that, Austin invested energy and time to grow that segment of the business. And I think it's very important to understand that when you import a piece of a business or a research arm or whatever, there's already revenue to behind it, so they tend to be more stable. Early stage startup kind of companies aren't anywhere near as stable as a research arm of a company or a manufacturing arm or what have you. So it gives you a nice base, and these organizations often spill out other kinds of startups because the people see opportunities in their company that the company isn't focused on, and they decide to go and start up a company to meet that opportunity, and a lot of that actually happens. Get the next one. So, you know, Austin has a lot of flatland, local control of electricity. You know, all these things are attractive for a chip manufacturing kind of company. But what's happened is we've attracted lots of other kinds of businesses. All the support infrastructure for a chip facility, so it's KLA-Tencor, Tokyo Electron, they've all come to Austin, maybe their headquarters, but usually a division of the company. let's see if I can get this. The next thing that happened was that, and it just happened this last year, is that Austin was competing for a Samsung electronics fab. And this is a big deal. It cost a lot of money. I'm not proposing you do it, but it wouldn't happen without public partnerships. Yes?
What's a fab?
Oh, it's where they make chips that go into your computer and into televisions and what have you. Sorry about that. For those techies, that they all know what a fab is. But it brings a large number of jobs. And it happened because we had some basic infrastructure, and over 35 years, the city and the state had invested in research facilities and other things around it to actually build up that, what I'll call critical mass. And you see that it's, you know, from a cost per job, it's very expensive. Austin's bigger, it has a very pro-growth environment, but it also drives other jobs, all the support jobs, and so you'll see lots of other jobs that are associated with that. I should point out that a lot of other things have happened as a result of that. There's a lot of spin-off technologies. And so what we're seeing is, I've seen some clean energy, a lot of clean energy work. In fact, the Austin Technology Incubator has a segment in clean energy. I've seen semiconductor wire deals. I've seen wind deals. There's lots of that stuff. So there's a lot of spin-off from research labs and larger companies. Um, clearly, Austin was successful with CHIPS, and so far, because technologies change, and at some point, the technology might change, and Austin would lose these fabs. In fact, some fabs have gone away, and so there's been some churn, and there's an awful lot of competition in Asia. But I would say Austin, because it focused on chips from a base which came just because we had the environment for it, we were kind of lucky. But because we did leverage it, you now have a very vibrant technology base associated with that kind of technology. So here's what, you know, maybe I can draw some conclusions from it. You've got to pick the right targets. We would like to have a biotech base. We don't. We probably won't have one unless we have a university with a university research center, and we don't. It's in MD Anderson in Houston, and it's in San Antonio, but we don't have anything in Austin. So we can't build it. We can't attract people. There's been a lot of desire in the public sector to do that, a lot of words, but in reality, the people in the private sector realize that we're not going to be able to do that. And so you have to be very realistic about what you can do and what you try to do. So that's, I think the, and you can, I'm not going to read these slides, so you can clearly see what you need to do. And I think from what I'm hearing from the speech, and I had dinner last night, thank you very much for having me dinner, it really is clear that these guys here are smart enough to take a look at what they have and are trying to grow that base, and that you can actually do. The important thing is that you're aligned, and so that both public and private are working together on that, and it's a very important role for the public sector to take on. Because if the public sector isn't behind it, it's hard to recruit organizations or pieces of organizations to your area. Let me take a crack at the build and grow, because we've done a lot of that in Austin, and it's another strategy. It's riskier, but it requires certain things to be successful. It usually requires people. I mean, that's the key component, entrepreneurs. I had breakfast this morning with Rob Capon. I don't know if you all know Rob. He and I worked together many, many moons ago in another company. I was working for a bigger company. We bought his company, and he and I worked together for 3 or 4 years helping to integrate that company and growing it. And we had a lot of fun. And so we sat down, and then we were now comparing. Now, Rob is a serial entrepreneur. I think this is his fourth deal that he's gotten, and he's been very good, very successful. And he's about 50 years old, and having breakfast with him, and I said, so tell me what you've learned and some of the issues that you've had. And we kind of comparing notes. It's amazing how similar lessons we've learned about starting up companies, he and both software and biotech, and I've stuck mostly to software and services. So it's you need those kind of folks, okay? And you need to attract them. Now there's another segment of the population. And then he's made a statement to me, which I thought was kind of funny. Yeah, I'm kind of 50, and this is going to be my last one. And I said, you know, Rob, I bet you it's not. You may say that. But if you retire and are at home and are not involved in something, you're going to be kind of bored pretty fast, so you'll probably find another opportunity, and you'll probably lead another company or two in your lifetime. And it's just because it's in the blood. And so you got to have those kind of folks. You got to have the support organizations behind it. You have to have people. And so that's really important to have those skills. One of the skills that's really often missing in these tech startups is the business skill. And that's what we tend to focus on in Austin. We have lots of great ideas, lots of products, you know, but you got to sell them. And I often ask CEOs when I interview them to
about their company and their plans and what they want to do. What do you think the marketing cost to sales is and the sales cost to sales? And I usually get this blank stare. Well, what do you mean? And it's telling because they really have not thought about how you're going to get this thing sold. They have a great product. They probably know the market they want to sell in, but how do they sell it? What's it going to cost to sell it? So these are skills that what we try to do is have the business people in Austin. We've got a lot of business people from a lot of different areas, both big companies and small companies, that are willing to spend their time to help these businesses grow and avoid making mistakes. And it's crucial for an area to get behind and help these companies. I consult a lot. I do a lot of that. And I've got tons of stories I can tell you about doing it. But the important thing is that there is a set of people, resources. It could be your angel group. It could be the entrepreneurial group. But people that are willing to give their time and energy to help people build successful plans and then execute them, because execution is absolutely crucial, and grow their top-line revenues. I always talk about the real milestone in early-stage companies is when you're making money, when you're cash flow positive and on a reoccurring basis. That's your real first big milestone. Then you can go up from there. And a lot of times, early-stage companies and entrepreneur will think about his first financing. Well, that's just an interim step. It's to use that money to actually grow the business and be successful. So getting organized in that area to help early-stage companies that happen, because if I'm working for some organization in this area and I have this idea on what to do, you got to have a place to go to vet the idea. I'll give you an example. I was in a coffee shop right around the corner from my house, actually, and this is a bunch of old guys tend to be there, but also a lot of startup people and young people are there. And one of the CEOs of a startup company in Austin called Finiscape, whom I know very well and I've worked with on another deal, said, hey, you've got to talk to this guy. Came over to me, I was just having a cup of coffee with another fellow. And he'll hang around a little bit if you talk to him. And so I said, sure, you know, I've got nothing else to do at the end of this. So I sat down there and listened to him. He's from IBM. He had this idea. He had this really interesting idea. And the idea is, it's kind of like Google is to data, but what he wants to do is have a database of people that have skill sets and you can kind of search for it and then have a voice or a chat interaction with them. And so it's at the idea stage. And I said, well, how are you going to make money on it? He said, well, I haven't figured that out yet, you know. I said, well, that's important. that's the obvious, but you know, it really is up front. So we started talking about it, and you know, I said, well, you know, I don't see this as a consumer kind of thing. Do you have an idea of how you might apply it in business? We said, oh, yeah, the whole idea came from the need in IBM. He's part of IBM Global Services. These people are all over the world, and it's very hard to find people with the right skill sets to answer questions. And they might be in India, they might be in China, they might be in South America. They're all over the place. And now we have a kind of a database of the basics, a picture, a name, and your job title, what have you. But we don't have a way for you to find the person that has the information you need. And that's where I thought that's where the idea came from. I said, well, that's great. Now we have a company who has the need, and now we have to figure out where to go in that company to be able to test whether, in fact, they would invest in that sort of a business. And so we cogitated a little bit, came up with the HR person, because the HR person typically has a skills database in a big company that's under wraps and they have their arms around it. If you make it available on their intranet so it's secure, you might, in fact, make them a hero and improve the performance of the organization. And so I said, you know, I don't know, but at least we have a place to go where we can go ask the questions. We put down the list of 50 kind of companies, and we picked the top dozen or so that we thought made some sense, usually the bigger ones, and said, now you can go to the HR people, build a little model, and ask the questions. And if you get a bunch of hits, and the first one you should go to is IBM, of course, because you're there and it's easy, and you get a lot of hits, well, maybe there is a business there. But the money you got to build a prototype might be redirected to build a prototype not for the public sector, but I mean for the consumer sector, but for businesses, because that's where money is. And that's saving them money and making them more efficient is the way to go. So, you know, it was a conversation. That's all it was as far as I was concerned. And it was fun. He was an interesting young man. He's probably in his 40s, not that young. And so he went off to go do this. Now, I don't know with him if I was right or wrong. I have no idea. He'll sort it out. But at least I got him onto a path where he can do some market research, try to figure it out, and if there is a business there, then you can go and develop it. And I do a lot of that. And it's kind of fun. And you want to provide the right amount of positive as well as negative information to help them think about what is the most important things they need to do and how to validate that business and what have you. So that's really what I do a lot of, and it's fun. And you need to have a group of people that have the skill sets. Maybe it's some of the retired people that have come to the area and just want to consult with businesses, you know, a day a week or something like that. There's lots of ways to generate, but it's an important part of it. And the other thing that you need is money. And you have an angel community, they can do some fundings. And the other piece is VC fundings. And while most of the VCs, I suspect, in this area are really in the Washington, D.C. area, it's not too far for them to come down here. And if you build relationships and hooks from your angel community to the VCs, then you can have a way to present a company that you've started here with angel money and get it to the next level with VC money. I think that's what we do. I think that's what most people do. I today look at mostly companies that I don't need VC money to get them the cash flow. But if we then figure out a great model and a great business and it's doing well and we can accelerate its growth with some VC money, then we'll go to the VC for some money. But we'll not have to give away all the equity of the company from the very early stage. And so that's another thing. And then there's SBIR grants. Rob told me that he got $8 million in SBIR grants, and they're grants from the government to help grow his business. So there are a lot of ways you do this, but money is very important, but the proper use of that money in creating value in the organization is what's most important. And that very often takes some gray hair. And by helping these people do the right things with the money and not squander away, they're actually creating more value and therefore able to keep more of the equity. Support organizations, law firms, they have a vested interest, but it's important that you got to have them. you can't do fundings without lawyers that understand that, and they have to have experience in dealing with the various kinds of fundings that are around and are able to advise the company properly. You really avoid a lot of problems by having a good attorney with the company. And so there is that infrastructure that's crucial. We have it in Austin. I suspect you have it here. Maybe it's a little bit less. But people understand IP, understand financing and business development contracts are typically the things that you need. Then there's accounting. Very small companies really don't need public accounting, but they have to have people that understand the accounting. To be able to do it right. And what I preach is, while Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't apply to small private companies, if you're probably going to sell this to a larger public company, you better set up your company properly, do the right thing. So the issue of SARS main oxy and how you've booked your revenue and you know, all the processes you've built into the company are appropriate and map right in. And that means that just a barrier goes away for an acquisition. Then marketing, PR, recruiters, all that other infrastructure is nice to have, and it's really important to grow these companies. The Technology Council, the Austin Technology Council, does very much what your Technology Council does. We are in the business of growing the existing base. The chamber and the state and the city are mostly involved in recruiting. So we're big enough, we've separated functions, and we have two different organizations working to do the separate things. And that works for us. For you, you're smaller, probably put it all together. It sounds like that's what you've done. That makes an awful lot of sense. Incubators are interesting things. We've historically, we've had an incubator since, something like that, when they built the MCC building that started the incubator. And it really was, for many years, a space play. And that's really all that it was. So you got space, monthly lease, and so, you know, if you grew, you as long as you fit in the incubator and they had space for you, that's great. And eventually, if you got too big, you had to move out. And that's what would happen. I think what happened in 2000 is we had a bubble burst. There was lots of space. And so you could sublet space all over the place. And so the incubator itself had to rethink its business model. What they've done is focus on two areas, wireless. We have about 100 wireless companies in town. And clean energy. We have fewer clean energy companies, but that's a very much growing segment, and we have some lot of activity in that area. And so those are the two segments that they're focused on, and they're building up those bases as we speak. And so they're focused, they're not trying to be all things to all people, and they have recruited a bunch of business types that understand growing businesses and what they need to do to work with these companies. In addition, they've recruited companies actually from overseas, from another country, to take spots in the incubator. Now, they have revenues already from their country of origin. One of them is Mexico, and I forgot where the other one's from. So these guys already have revenues. They already have a base in their country. And what the incubator is trying to do is help them expand into the U.S. It's another strategy. So they tend to be small. They are they're bringing in some people. They're hiring some people locally. And now they're trying to grow their business, and you're providing expertise in Austin with the various people that we have to help them grow their business. And it's actually starting to work, and they're starting to get some revenues. And they're not having to raise money. It's just a matter of growing their business, and they're starting to get to it. And marketing in the U.S. is very different than marketing in Europe or marketing in Mexico. Let's see. One of the So let's. I mean, here's my what we learned, or what you need to do. I was going to give you another story about another company, but I'm not sure what the time is here. Key success factors. How do you make this work? Well, I've talked a lot about them. The most important thing you can do is expertise. It's all over the place, especially if you have successful executives that are moving here and retired. That exists. You somehow have to figure out how to harness it. There's about 100 of us in Austin that do kind of what I do. And, you know, an entrepreneur will contact us, send us a plan, or ask for a coffee meeting or what have you, and we'll go. And we make it easy for them to gain access to people that have some gray hair that can give them some advice. Now, I know they tend to go to two or three, and that's really good. I encourage that because I say, yeah, don't just talk to me because I'm not right most of the time. I'm right some of the time, maybe. You need to talk to maybe this guy or this guy because they have more knowledge in that in your space or something like that. And so we try to get them to the right group of advisors to help them get from wherever they are to the next stage. And I think that's a very important thing that you have. So it's very open and very straightforward, and people give their time very, very willingly. And instead of playing golf one day, you'll work with a company or an afternoon or a morning, whatever is required. And it's fun. It's interesting. And I think you need to find a way to harness these people that are moving into your area that have been successful in business, may have sold a business or may have worked for a big business, and they have a lot of skills. Let's see. Okay, so we've talked about both grow and build, and I think you need to focus on both sides of it. Now let's talk a little bit about what happens and what happened pre and post bubble. Pre-bubble, we had lots and lots of activity. Lots of money was flowing. It was like money was free. It was amazing. After the bubble, jobs went away. We lost about 35,000 tech jobs in the area. We have about 150,000 right now. Money stopped flowing. It really was, are we going to survive kind of thing. And what happened is you stopped funding the very early stage deals, but the people that really wanted to start a company that survived that had much better plans, much better products, much better service, more focused, more senior people. And so Austin recovered because the quality of, I'll call it early stage companies, there are a lot fewer of them, but they're much better. And so they're the ones that have survived and are growing. And so you see the cycle happening, and you wonder whether you're going to recover. I think in 2001, people were thinking, well, this is, you know, going to go away. And in fact, what happens is, and I think it's just the American spirit, really, is after a while, things were incubating in companies. They didn't leave the companies. They were incubating them and thinking about them. And then when things got a little bit better, they had much richer plans, much better plans, and they got funded, and they've started to, and we've recovered just about all those jobs. In fact, we're ahead of where we were in 2000. So you can certainly recover. We'll have cycles. You got to believe that you can get through those cycles, and I think the way to do that is you got to be organized to focus on it. So to finish up, I think I see here that you're doing a lot of what Austin is doing, has done. It's a long path. It took 30 years for Austin to develop where it is today. I see here you actually are somewhere like Austin was in the early 80s. You know, and there's a lot of activity. You get a lot of things happening, and you have to focus on a few things where you can make it really work. I think I learned something from an executive that I worked for long, long ago. So if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And what you're doing here is trying to pick a few roads to get you to a place where you want to be. I suspect keeping that in mind is an important part of what you're going to do over the next 10 years, so to speak.